going to be the case. I first came to this church in about 1985 when we were on holiday at Underhill, and it was an interesting service, I have to say. It was a somewhat anarchic baptismal Eucharist in Fred Rochlard's time. I think I managed to come again other years as well, but that's when I first entered this building. But it had a certain impact on me in that when the living of Milham came vacant some years later, when was it now, 2002, I thought, oh, we might as well have a look, for what it's worth. And when we came for interview and so forth, and other folk did a tour of all the churches, I said, I don't need to go to Holy Trinity. I know exactly what it looks like, and I know how much I should feel at home then, if I come to it. So, you can understand why certain buildings can have an impact on you. And some of that is what you are actually experiencing now that is tangible and visible, and you can capture it on film and recording. And some of it is that rather more amorphous, intangible, metaphysical, spiritual dimension that just says there is that which is other about a place. And that could be somewhere like this with a roof on it, it could be somewhere like Swinside, a stone circle outside. There can be that which is other that gets hold of you. And therefore anything that one says about this church, you are drawing on what you see and experience now. But you're also very well aware that you are drawing on and absorbing the generations who have gone before, and for whom this has been a significant place. Now, there's all those little bits and pieces built into the exterior of this church that may tell a tale going way back. All sorts of stones in the boundary wall of the churchyard. And we've heard before, and scholars like Angus Winchester have had plenty to say on the subject, which we still have a lot to learn from. And I'm not going to venture onto their territory. Because I tend to go simply on documents, preferably as original documents as you could possibly find. And we're very lucky here because this church had a curate. 1895 to 1900. It wasn't even his first curacy. Mr. Sykes, quite a character. He died about 1950. He was married, and I'm not necessarily going to commit myself to saying that much more about him, William Slater Sykes, except that anybody who'd served a previous curacy in Goole may have thought that coming round these parts was a bit different. But he just sank himself into it, and its documentation, and the area. And, you know, if he saw that there was a tale about a holy well or an old spring, he went to look for it, tracked it down. And he went through all the available manuscript and other materials, and he compiled countless notebooks, and he corresponded. Even long after he had left this place into that he was working with and corresponding with Mary Fair and with Frank Warrener. And that was Frank Warrener, who always did anyone here actually know Frank Warrener? Was he just a name? Well, he wrote a lot about men and people and places, and quite a lot of it, to be honest, I think he actually cribbed from Mr. Sacks, or at least Mr. Sacks was very generous with his own researches. But when Mr. Sacks was here, you'd have, well, from what we see now, you'd barely have recognised the place. It was much gloomier. More windows were blocked up. That one there in the corner, that big window there in the Huddleston aisle, that one, that was blocked up. As well as the door beside it, which we might well be unblocking, am I right? That would be a very good one up. But we would you have felt at home here? The floor level would have been different, because they'd raised it up in order to try to do something about the damp. Presumably it was actually rising down because it didn't solve the problem. It just rose even further. But you'd have looked around, and when he was here, of course, there wouldn't be the War Memorials. There wouldn't be one or two other more recent stained glass like that. There'd have been the Huddleston tombs, though not quite in those positions. I gather they've only been in that sort of position since about 1930. And what else? Oh, there would have been an organ in that far corner there. So that would have been taking up some of the room in front of that window, and it would have obscured the view of the fish window. So that wouldn't have been a great improvement. And up here in the chancel, well, it wouldn't have been as wide, and it wouldn't have been as light, and some of it would have been obscured by this pulpit, because that would have been a lot loftier. It would have been a real three-decker. And what else would have been different? Oh, you wouldn't have had the reredos. You look at that now with those lovely barley sugar pillars at each side of it. And various persons have been fooled into thinking it's genuine 17th century. As far as I can make out, it's 1930. But it's a very good facsimile, as it were. The only surviving woodwork that is part of the communion rails on which the rest were modelled when they were positioned. What else is ancient, really ancient? There's a bit of pew, that tiny bit of pew over there. Age, I would have thought, distinctly uncertain. Medieval? Maybe later? Does it look very comfortable? I suppose you can sink your elbows on it at the sides, so there's something to it. It's not. But again, this. The survival from Victorian times is this all these pews. Before that, they would have been much more primitive, and maybe not that many of them. So what? What have we got? We've got a Norman church, an entrance arch of about 1120, nice and tall and nice and narrow. And there wasn't a porch, a built a sheltering porch outside then. That was only added in memory of the redoubtable John Irving, who had been Mr. Sacks's vicar. He died in 1910, was it? Or was it 1906? 1906. The porch came in 1910. And was designed by an architect in Ulverston, who also, incidentally, designed, though didn't sculpt, the war memorial in the centre of Milan, the statue of Michael conquering the dragon. So that's an interesting thing. There's a beautiful old engraving of the porch that you may have seen a copy of. In fact, if this book is ever reissued, that's to say, if a grant is obtained for republishing it, one could have it. It could be a huge term. So I just leave that as a thought for anybody else, perhaps in the society, to have handy. Before I go any further, maybe one should point out that this guidebook and complementary things to it actually came out of a proper community project. Perhaps you were part of them. And they took their origin from the fact that people thought, you know, that there is a story about this place that we can tell. And how much better if we get a group together to do a bit of researching, to do a bit of studying. And not least, to taking our cue from something which at the time was just lying somewhere in a cupboard. Not lying in a cupboard now, because of course it's in a frame there at the back in the aisle. An embroidery of signatories, of donors, who put their money in their pockets in the 1920s in time of depression to try and raise money to restore the church. And the odd thing about the tapestry, and there's another little booklet about that, you can go on plugging it as well if there's enough, it was never finished. Some people had penciled in their names, or in ink it was there, but they never embroidered over them. But it was a considerable thing. And part of the project, the Knights and Needles project, was actually somebody who took part in it, by the way, who's here today. Margaret, yes. Anybody else? Yeah. Oh, yeah, you did. Did you enjoy it? It was great fun, and the good thing was that it was a good piece of cooperative working that said the best thing to do is to study together. And so it wasn't a matter of just going along and having a handout on something or other, or me mugging up various research on things I didn't really want to mug up with, like the English Civil War and that sort of stuff. But the tales of the donors, because then we were looking at family history as well, so that became a sort of project in its own right, the Knights and Needles project. So we had the Knights, which looked at the history, and then we had the Needles, who looked at the signatories. And that had just been folded up in a cupboard in church. That was right, wasn't it? Yeah. I think we've run out by now of cupboards to find things in, which is rather sad. But if you do find any more lost cupboards in church, do let me know, because you can never tell. So you're dealing with a church going back to, on this site, maybe something before, but certainly 12th century, early 12th century, and a very characteristic, very tall, very narrow Romanesque arch. And presumably added to it at some point, or maybe just possibly originally the chancel was just the original church. Maybe there was just that and the name was added to that, who can say. And then in the 13th century, the beginnings at least of the South Isle, the so-called Hubbardston Isle, and that presumably in more than one stage, because the windows certainly of it as we have them now are from the 14th century, and we do indeed have some documentation of various times when money was left and work was in progress. And the big difference between a church with very narrow windows, as the nave narrower even than that, as narrow as the surviving tiny window there in the chancel. It would have been gloomy, it would have been probably smelly and damp probably. Get that, just on the damp, I'd be interested to know if, because we often see the old engravings of this place making it look as if you could sail up to the castle and the church. I'm wondering whether the land in question down that way would actually have been very damp. Would it have been underwater?
Don't ask me.
No, I'm just wondering whether there might be an answer to that question.
Well, probably prone to flooding, yeah.
Yeah, prone to flooding, at the very least.
But more than it is now.
Yeah, more than it is now. Yeah. Because after all, the town, as Minna was, the town, as it were, was actually this sort of slightly raised up area.
Well, that land was drained in 1833 by a Mr. Ben.
Was it? That particular thing?
I
haven't got... Oh, right. So we do know a bit about that. Yeah. So prior to that, it would have been, at least you'd have had to wade through.
The castle shores, close estuary.
I thought it wasn't just a fancy, just for the sake of the picturesque. So you've got your church, you've got your nave, you've got that very strange, odd-shaped arch at the far end. It's highly disguised nowadays, of course, but it's more visible as a locked-up arch from the outside. And whether that ever gave entrance to a tower or to a charnel house or to indeed a tiny poky little vicarage, who can say? And now of course it's full of switches, electrical equipment, but there it is visible to your inspection. Medieval Milham. Our view of it, our sort of sense of it, our documentation of it is almost wholly tied up with the doings of the Huddleston family and their various enterprises, their various heroic or otherwise exploits, their land holdings. They were a Yorkshire family and their interests elsewhere. Later on they were not principally resident here at all. They had estates elsewhere in Gloucestershire, was it? And as well as links still with Yorkshire. They ruled the roost. They held imperial Milham, as it were. They had the right to turn you off if they felt you were misbehaving. So, yes, it was a primitive time, we would now say. But they left their mark and they left their legacy. And of course they left that strange, presumably fragment of a funeral effigy, dear old terrible Dick. He were a doughty warrior, was that Richard Huddleston, fought at Agincourt, we're told. But he's more notable because prior to that he was a very wild character, and but you know all this, don't you? He turned up at the castle one day when Dad was away and just threw his weight around and went around raping and pillaging and generally spoiling everything. Just was not a nice man. But presumably he mended his ways a little later. Anyway, but that's probably... But again you sort of ask why? From then, in terms of things that could easily get put on the scrap heap or on the bonfire, why do you end up with just these little problems? But that's what you get. But you also get, and this is interesting when you see how pious these people were, the members of the Huddleston family in the post-Civil War period, where they were making a bit of money out of things, they were making a bit of money out of exploiting mineral rights and so forth. And they made sure that after their decease, their praises were sung in a learned language like Latin. and that nobody was going to forget them or their wife. And it's quite an extraordinary sort of survival that too, though battered about a bit, is still there. And of course, the sort of sense of, it's been hard to tell when you're looking around, because I mean, here you are sitting in pews facing the right way, as it were. But before the restoration of 1930, the pews on the other side, in the aisle, were all facing inwards. And they would have been occupying even more space and cramming other things in, and that was before, of course, the font was moved from the back to there. It would have been a very... if you look at older photographs, and they do exist, of the church prior to the 1930 restoration, you can just see how dim and pent up it was. But part of that was all about the idea was that the worship was really very static. You turn up and the parish clerk, and that was quite a sort of hereditary office in those days, pipes up, yes, on a real pitch pipe, but we've got them lying around. Not that they're still working when anyone tests them. And in a probably, whether they were really good singers or not, but you sort of, you got all lined out. So you sing one line of a metrical psalm, and then everybody repeats it. And they've got watches to look at to see when they can go home. And they haven't got clocks on the wall to keep an eye on. They might have had an hourglass or something, but that would be just so the preacher could look at it, see it had gone right down, then invert it and carry on. You got a sense of worship as something that is done to you for your edification, rather than as something in which you are actively participating joyfully, cheerfully, happily, willingly, without any sense of other censorship, or that, you know, it was going to buy you any privileges. So you've got monuments, and you've got a host of monuments to worthy or locals, some of them laity, some of them clergy, some of them who were sort of died in haymaking accidents.
Robert?
Oh, have I...
your foot.
Oh, yeah, right. Like poor Mr. Cooley, 1907, Mr. Irving's successor, various persons who died drowning in the Duddon. Other persons who... Ah, yes, Mr. Piketar, Mr. Pickthall. Yes. He may have been a Queen's College Oxford man, but round here he was more known for going off to cockfights and having to be brought back for them because he got a funeral. You just don't have that problem anymore. And then Mr. Bolton and his family, yes, they Now here's the thing, because we often imagine that everything in a church is in situ, has always been in that position. Well, you look at older photographs, and that rather nice altarpiece, as it were, there, that's hanging on the wall, which is another nice piece of work, that you see pictured on the back wall there, underneath the fish window. That was after that other big organ in the corner had been removed. So things change in a church, and yet we persuade ourselves that they've always been the same. I mean, it was only in my time that the Stations of the Cross appeared. And they appeared in a rather strange way. Am I right? They were in the chapel at Wormwood Scrubs. He's right, and we were very fortunate with the prison chaplain then in Milham, who had he been at the Scrubs? As chaplain, I mean. That's it, yes.
And you rescued them from the
skip. You rescued them from the skip. And thought we'd make a good home. And so we were. Have been. Will be. But no, there were some great times those were, yes. So they weren't there. The other thing, and this is where, again, any sort of new history would have a lot to put in. The Chancellor, of course, is 1930. And one has to say that Mr. Fithian Adams, very scholarly archaeologist as well as cleric, was a man of action. And just when he came here, said, come on, you've been collecting this money, you've been embroidering this thing, recording all your names, we've got to get on with it. The time for not doing something about this church, you know, it escaped the clutches of Palin and Austin before because you haven't got the $3,000 to spend then. And so they ended up in, I think, was it about 10,000 they ended up spending in 1930. Not a good time to be doing things, you might think, but they did in 1930. And the whole restoration work completed between early June and early November, which is quite extraordinary when you think about it, because it was very extensive and radical. Because it was thought that the chancel arch was out of skew, and you can see how the rest of the chancel, because of the facing and the treatment of it, has all been rebuilt. I've seen photographs of it where you can see that they brought down the walls all the way around. And I think that was the very first thing they went to do, that demolition job. It was in that demolition job, of course, that they found all sorts of other bits and pieces that had been built in, because the wall must have had to have treatment before, possibly because of damage in the Civil War, and was in a terrible state. I mean, it was not very much was holding it together. And you just get the sense that it was living on borrowed time before it fell down. So down come the walls carefully, presumably kept all the stone on site, kept as far as possible to the what was deemed to be the proper floor plan, and the result is what you see today. And I wonder whether you would have got that work done in that sort of time scale to that sort of quality. But they got a good firm of architects from Newcastle, I think it was. They had an indefatigable rector. They had an encouraging bishop in Burglar Bill, as it was always called. There's a pub in Keswick, I forget which one it is. But top end, towards the top of it, he'll be on the market hall and all that sort of thing. But up there, if you go in there, they've got a caricature of Burglar Bill, the bishop. He just looks so pugnacious and so tough. You wouldn't trifle with him. He paid a pastoral visit here to the churchyard into the Adams's time, and looked around at all the awful. Do you remember when we used to have domes, glass domes over flower arrangements in churchyards? I think he went around and smashed a lot of them because he hadn't got a faculty. all sorts of other things he didn't find there, and so Mr. Fithian Adams dutifully brought everything back into order. And then, having done what he needed to do here, just left to get on with it. But you do see that a church grows and develops Because its use grows and develops, the perceptions people have of it and the way they value it develop, the capacity of people to take responsibility has been so much more thrown upon them. You know, the days when the 12 men, the vestry, ruled all matters ecclesiastical and civil in the area are long gone. The church wardens now do not need to run a workhouse. And let's hope that politicians don't make it essential for them to do anything like that again, he says with gritted teeth. Because, you know, but it was a time when that was where leadership was centred in quite a few very powerful, but nonetheless not necessarily terribly enlightened hands. We're also lucky because there's a good write-up about the church in all the salient features. The only thing it doesn't do is say buy the guidebook, but it's a very good write-up about Milan generally, in the Buildings of England series. Who's got a copy?
Not of Cumbria, but I've got one of Lancashire.
Oh, well, they should definitely have one of Cumbria. It was because Matthew Hyde, when he was doing his research for it, was sensible enough to call. And I hope we pointed him in all the right directions. So it, almost all notable buildings in the area do get a mention, as they would never have done in Pevsner's original edition. So it's a very good and accurate write-up about this church, and indeed about St. George's, and St. Luke's, and St. Anne's. And it does include the standing stones of Kirksandon and the stones of Swinside. Strangely, it doesn't include, among our sort of local great houses, doesn't include Broadgate. Strange. Perhaps I just omitted to mention Broadgate. Well, anywhere else in that direction, but I would have thought that that was on one of the usual listings. I would have thought, but no mention. Anyway, I've not completely run out of steam, but what I'm suggesting is that we need to keep having ways of developing new ways of reading a church and how it's come to be as it is now, and why some things in it are still here but are not terribly prominent. I mean, who notices now that the royal arms are hanging there up on the wall in the gallery and we can actually see them? And how many people look at the verses from the Psalms which are on the two lozenges here on the wall? I think I would dearly love to know a bit more accurately what their period is, and whether they've always been visible or whether at some point they were hidden under whitewash that covered everything. The other thing to do when you're looking at inside a church, where you can never tell, in all probability, when those round arches were first built, they would have been painted. There would have been colour. If you can find any colour on them, I'd be very impressed. Forensic scientists can come and do a, as it were, criminology job, whether they'd find anything all these years on, or whether people would come around hosing down the place from time to time to obliterate signs. But probably sort of chevron shapes. That would have been quite typical for the era. Because otherwise, it's rather typical of this part of the country. I mean, we haven't got any wall paintings. We haven't got, apart from the notches where you can see it was built in. We haven't got any sign, any evidence of the rood loft, even though they were repairing the rood beam, I think, into the 18th century. But there's nothing now to show except those notches in the chancel arch. And of other things where there might have been, you see, this is, if I could just come around here, if you're looking at other little bits, this here, you've got this notch in there. Now, is that from a pew or from some sort of reading desk? No, that was there, stretching across to there. Because again, this, you know, what's been in all these holes here? What's been built in? I don't know. But I hope that's a bit of an infusing. Just try to infuse for everybody else to dig deeper. And that's an interesting memorial plaque. Nice metal one. Genuine. Who knows the church at Mancaster? Well, that is full in the chancel of monuments to members of the the Pennington family, and it's got all sorts of metal plaques in antique script to various family members. The plaques are all fakes. They're not as old as they purport to be. And on the outside of the church, on the outside, the Mancaster on the east wall, east facing wall, they're not. Most of the stones are not genuine and original either. They're just part of a sort of romantic Victorian vision of what ought to have been there, so they spent their money on putting it there. I think that's enough.
I think that's excellent.
Thank you.
Can I suggest that we have a break? But before we have the break, if you've got any questions to ask Robert now, or if you want to think about them, we'll have a Q&A. There's the questions. Yeah?
Sorry, I'm a questioner. Sorry about that. The book you mentioned, is it still available? The book about
buildings? Oh yes, the present series is growing exponentially. So they come at a cost. I forget what this one called. Ask it for Christmas. It's called The Buildings of England, Cumbria, and it covers Cumberland, Westmorland and Furness. Matthew Hyde and Nicholas Posner. Posner, yes. So it's published nowadays, as so many good books are published by Yale University Press. They're very good at publishing quality books and keeping the price down. Came out in this edition came out in 2010. Posner. Hyde and Posner. Hyde with a Y. Matthew Hyde and Nicholas Posner. Both of them sadly are now dead. Yeah. So it's a memorial to both of them.
Any more questions? No? Can I suggest that we have a break now then? Is that all right? Sort of a 10 or 15 minutes break where you can... Are we all right to have a cup of tea and... If you want to go and get a cup of tea and a piece of cake? We'll have a break and maybe wander around and maybe actually, whilst he's here, you know, use him. For want of a better expression.
Pleasure you are to be used.
Sorry, Brian.
Right.
Yeah.
Good.
Right. We're all right. If we have a bit of a break. Because last time we had it, people complained that they got sore bottoms.
I don't want
any complaints of sore bottoms today. So if you get up and have a bit of a break, a bit of a stretch.
Nice.